Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 1 week from today will mark the fourth anniversary of the Mother Emanuel shooting in Charleston. On June 17, 2015, members of the historically black church welcomed a young white man to join them for Bible study. He sat there with them and, at one point, without warning, pulled a Glock from a pack hanging at his waist and began firing. Dylan Roof succeeded in killing 9 innocent souls that day, but remarkably, several days later, some relatives of the dead stood at the boy's hearing and said, "I forgive you." That moment shaped the media narrative about this tragedy and its aftermath. But Jennifer Barry Hawes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at Charleston's Post and Courier, says the story is much more complicated. And she untangles those complications in her new book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. We asked Jennifer Barry Hawes to lead us through the untangling of that story, and she joins us for the hour from Charleston. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This incident obviously shocked the entire nation, and for nearby communities like ours, there were reverberations of this senseless tragedy. Former North Carolina State Senator Malcolm Graham, a Charlottean, lost his sister, Cynthia Hurd, in that shooting. But Charleston must have been consumed to its core by what happened. How would you describe how your city reacted?
Well, you're absolutely right. The city was consumed, and for quite a while afterward. Initially, while the shooter was still on the loose, there was a lot of fear and worry about, you know, where was he? Were there multiple shooters? Were there additional attacks planned? And once he was arrested, then there was just this time of tremendous mourning. You had 9 funerals, of course. There was a lot of talk about the shooter's racist views. And of course, we saw the pictures of him holding the Confederate flag, which then launched another enormous conversation about what to do with the flag. Should it be lowered? It had been lowered from atop the State House dome maybe 10 years earlier or so, and put on a flagpole out front of the building so it still flew in a prominent location. So there was tremendous discussion about what to do with that and other Confederate monuments, some of the conversations that still go on today. So the city was just in a state of upheaval. It was June, so it was high tourist season. There were many, many visitors in town. Everything was filled. There were enormous vigils. It was just a really surreal time. Mm.
Your book takes the time to explore the story of that day, but also the aftermath of what happened to the families, to survivors of those who were taken. And we'll get into all of what you discovered in a moment. But I'm wondering if you knew before your reporting began that the story that really captured the world, the forgiveness by some family members of the shooter, if you knew that that was not the whole story, not even the real story, or did that reality come through as a result of your reporting?
Well, initially there was, you'll recall, of course, the bond hearing you're talking about, in which there were 5 family members who spoke. And then shortly thereafter, we had a couple of other events that sort of sealed that narrative. There was a huge unity walk across the Arthur Ravenel Bridge here. People from both sides of the bridge, black and white, old and young, people came together and celebrated a moment of unity. And that was another very inspiring moment. And as I mentioned, we had a lot of vigils that drew diverse audiences and that sort of thing. So that there were a couple of weeks almost there where it felt, while the tragedy was terrible, inspiring. It was afterward when we started to hear people talk about the idea of whether forgiveness, in fact, let off the hook those who would prefer not to address racism and the white supremacy that drew the shooter and really have a more nuanced view. We also began to hear from people who objected to the forgiveness narrative for other reasons, or they were just themselves not able to forgive right away and didn't really want to forgive right away. They wanted to have a better understanding of what had happened to their loved ones. So for me, realizing that narrative was much more complicated came over time. There were glimpses of it early on, but it really came to be clear as we move forward.
Well, the national media and perhaps the worldwide media that covered this story seemed to latch on to this idea of the extraordinary nature of people forgiving somebody who'd killed their loved ones in cold blood at a Bible study meeting of all things. And that became the story. And maybe it's because we all want something to hope for, or we want some inspiration from this moment of evil in the world. And it is true that some did use their faith to forgive evil, but you also say that's not the truth. One part of the truth that emerged was that Charleston's complicated relationship with race hadn't really changed. That's what you say, I believe, in one of your interviews. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
Sure. The idea of forgiveness is one that's, of course, deep-seated in the church, and particularly the Black church. And that part of it was very inspiring. As you mentioned, you know, you're coming off this terrible, terrible tragedy, and people want to find hope where they feel very despondent. But the reality is that the history of Charleston remained. You know, that forgiveness didn't change anything. And here in Charleston, that history informs almost everything about the city. Charleston, of course, was the epicenter of the slave trade. And everywhere you go here, there's some kind of story related to that time. And it's usually stuffed into some long-forgotten closet corner of that history. You know, bear in mind, this is a place where former slave plantations have become tourist stops. You know, we hold weddings there. People go to see the beautiful grounds there. We don't, now we're doing a better job of it, but we still don't do an honest enough job at discussing what the history of those plantations really is. These were, you know, forced labor camps with enslaved people working and dying, and that's just not something that we associate with the plantation. We think of a beautiful garden and a beautiful house. And this all plays out in really personal ways for the people who live here, and particularly the people who are involved in this shooting.
And tourists may not think about this, but you point out that there was some irony even on the night of that shooting as to where they took the survivors after the shooting. They needed to get them out of the church so the police could do their work, and so they moved them first to a hotel, and then they thought the hotel was too close to the scene of the crime, and so they moved them to a building that was built to protect white people from slaves. And so they put these folks in that building to protect them from this white person.
Mm-hmm. That's just such an ironic moment, isn't it? And it's, if you think about it, it's all over the city. So these kind of stories exist on every street you go down. But that particular night, the survivors, they left the church with the police. And they went, as you said, right across the street to a hotel. Then they moved them a little less than a block away. And the walk from one hotel to another took them past Marion Square, where there is a 115-foot-high monument to John C. Calhoun, a former vice president who was one of the most ardent defenders of slavery. They walk past the Calhoun Monument. They go into what's now an embassy suites. It's a almost like a castle-looking building. And that building was built after Denmark Vesey, an enslaved man, tried to organize a massive slave rebellion in the city in 1822. The authorities discovered it and hanged him and about three dozen of his alleged co-conspirators. And that building was built basically as an arsenal and a lookout to watch for other slave uprisings. The city of Charleston at the time was majority Black because of the number of slaves in the city. That building then went on to be the home of the Citadel. It's not the home of the Citadel now, obviously, it's a hotel. But the cadets from the Citadel, of course, fired the first shots of the Civil War. So just that little journey that those survivors took less than a block walked us through so much Charleston history, and that's the case virtually everywhere here.
You began your reporting on this story not as an author of a book, but as a reporter for the Charleston Post and Courier, a religion reporter. So this really struck in the middle of your area of expertise. But when did you know that the media narrative that was developing nationally was not the story? When did that occur to you?
It really struck me. Well, there were a number of instances, but the first one that really hit me over the head was that a couple of months after the shooting, the two survivors in the room, the two adult survivors, Felicia Sanders and Polly Shepherd, sat down with me to talk about what happened that night. And it was the first time that they had reached a point where they felt they could discuss it. Mm-hmm. So we talked, and then we agreed to meet at the church the following day to take a portrait of them in the sanctuary. Now, bear in mind, this is a church where Felicia's family has attended for generations. Polly is a trustee. So we meet there, and the church leadership refuses to let us in to take this picture. Now, it's a, you know, weekday morning. There's nobody in the sanctuary. I've done this a million times with other churches for other stories. And so we wound up standing outside as people debated what to do. And Felicia, who had, you know, just 2 months earlier, laid in the fellowship hall, you know, in the blood of her loved ones, including her son, was standing outside crying. I've lost my son, and now I'm losing my church. And I had this moment of just epiphany of how deep the division with the church had become. I knew there were some complaints about how donations were handled and that sort of thing, but this was on a whole different level. And at that moment, I realized there's a whole lot more going on in their lives than what we realized.
And we will explore some of those fissures as we go through this hour with Jennifer Barry Hawes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Charleston News and Courier, who has written Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. We'll come right back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Jennifer Barry Hawes. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Charlotte News and Courier, who has written a book called Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Monday of next week, June 17th, marks the fourth anniversary of that horrible tragedy at the AME Church in Charleston, the Mother Emanuel Church. It took several months before a decision to write this book was made, and in fact, it wasn't your decision. And I'm curious about why a literary agent would come to a religion reporter for the Charleston Post and Courier to suggest an idea for a book when they probably didn't know what you knew about the difference in the story, that it wasn't the story being reported in the national media.
New York, Albert Lee, who wound up being the agent on this book, and he had read the story I mentioned earlier about the survivors and some other things we'd written about questions that had arisen about the dispersing of the donations and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, you ought to consider writing a proposal for a book. And, you know, I'm a newspaper reporter. And so as we started talking, I said, you know, there really is so much more to this story that we've written in pieces, but would be fascinating to put all together. And that sentiment only grew as the story moved forward. So it really was his thinking about it, you know, from New York and what he was reading. I thank him for having the idea. It certainly was true that there was far, far more to the story than what most people knew, certainly outside of Charleston.
Yeah, reporters write the initial drafts of history as they happen, and often these stories develop with different reporters handling different aspects of this, and it comes out over time, and it may be difficult for readers to aggregate all that information and come up with the true story. How does your book help people come away with a better understanding of not only what happened that day, but how people dealt with the tragedy going forward?
Well, they'll certainly learn more about the survivors and the family members' relationship with the church, which to me was a key one that many people didn't realize. And also divisions, as I said, over money and forgiveness. There were divisions within families over forgiveness, but more broadly, there were some families that were very committed to forgiving Dylann Roof. There were some families who were not forgiving at all. Some people wanted the death penalty, some did not. You know, one of the things I really wanted to communicate is that this was not a homogenous group of people. These were just like any people. They all had different opinions. They came from different backgrounds. So while they were generally in the group of being obviously African-American residents of this country, you know, they're all very different, different personalities. They don't all live in Charleston. That's another common misconception, is that these were all families who lived here. In fact, many did not. And so they're, you know, coming from different points of view from their homes, within their families. It's just, you know, they're all different, and it's a very complicated story, and I wanted people to come away with an understanding.
It's a story of how people deal with tragedy in their own and very different ways sometimes, and it can split families apart in terms of how, and did in fact do that, in terms of how they dealt with what happened. Nationally, as we read these stories from afar, obviously we focused on the tragedy, then the astonishing forgiveness that some people gave the killer who lost loved ones, and then, of course, President Obama's eulogy of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney at his funeral, and later, then-Governor Nikki Haley's successful push to bring down the Confederate flag in front of the State House, which was remarkable in its own way. But the cracks in the veneer began to emerge even as all of that was going on, at least in Charleston, or quickly thereafter. You write about that, and you spoke already a little bit this morning about the Bridge of Peace, or the Bridge to Peace Unity March over the Arthur Ravenel Bridge. Remind us what that was, why it occurred.
So the weekend after the shooting, the church reopened, and basically a group of women from Mount Pleasant, which sits on the other side of the Cooper River from downtown Charleston, began this Facebook idea of this unity march, and it just exploded and became this enormous event where people gathered on both sides of the Cooper River, which is a very large river that goes along one side of the peninsula of Charleston, and they marched up the bridge, which is about 3 miles long, and met in the middle. And there was this exuberant cheering and hugging and crying. People had signs, and it was just absolutely inspiring to see all of these people from different races, many of them visitors, people from Charleston. It was just amazing. The pictures from it were beautiful. But the subtext there was that very little was done to actually address racism and racial disparities in a systemic way after, so that many people were concerned that while that was all very inspiring, had it in fact sort of taken some of the energy out of pushing for real change. On the other hand, of course, people didn't want Charleston to be a city that erupted in violence, and we didn't. And keep in mind that the Emanuel shooting occurred just a couple months after Michael Slager, a police officer, shot and killed Walter Scott, a black motorist who was unarmed and was running away from him. So the city was already on edge.
Also in Charleston, North Charleston.
In North Charleston, yes. Correct. So not the same jurisdiction, but very close.
Yeah.
So the cities and this whole region were already sort of tense and on edge. So the unity walk, I think, kind of gave people a sense, well, okay, we're not going to erupt in violence, and Charleston's going to set a different example.
How vocal were the people who felt that this unity march, which everybody celebrated, actually glossed over these racial disparities, and how widely covered was that sentiment in the media in Charleston?
In Charleston, it was not a prevalent view that I heard. What I heard was a lot of people who were very proud of their city. I think people were afraid of bad-mouthing it right off the bat, especially because we were going through the funerals and all of that. And so that bubbled up, from what I heard, more slowly afterward. I think people wanted to be respectful to the families. Mm-hmm. Many of the family members, well, there were five who spoke at the shooter's bond hearing. So there wasn't a feeling of let's be respectful, nobody wants violence at this time. There were agitators coming to town that the police and many black pastors and other activists were trying to keep at bay so that the city did not wind up, you know, in flames. So that sentiment in Charleston came out more after. Now, in other parts of the country, that was a topic of considerable discussion right off the bat.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that the Confederate flag came down from the State House in Columbia at the urging of Nikki Haley, the Republican governor, who is a gun owner, for one thing, and although she is a woman of color, that is That is a momentous occasion in a southern state, and particularly the state that led the Confederacy into seceding from the Union. Was that not viewed as a major positive step in racial reconciliation in South Carolina?
Well, it was, but I think that there's a quote in the book from Reverend Joe Darby, an AME minister, who basically said something to the effect of, all it took was the lives of nine black people.
Right.
So, yes, people were who were not flag supporters were delighted to see it come down, but at what cost? And their point was, why did it take an event of this magnitude to lower something that in their minds was clearly a symbol of racism?
Well, there's no rule book when things like this happen. No one knows what to do, quite honestly. And I think the initial thought is to not step on the toes of those who have been so terribly hurt, but to honor the people who have lost their lives in situations like this in a way that that is meaningful to not only the people who are hurting, but also to the community at large. What would people who didn't like what happened at the Ravenel Bridge March, what would they like to have seen happen?
I think they would like to see, and still would like to see, particularly gun reform. That gun law reform is a biggie for the families and people close to the story. They were hoping that at least the South Carolina legislature would pass an extension of the amount of time you wait to get a background check
completed. Which they did not.
Which they did not. You'll remember that Roof really should not have been able to get his firearm because he had an arrest for a controlled substance, which could indicate that he was a user or abuser of a controlled substance.
Mm-hmm.
He did apply for a background check. The check did not come back because it got tangled up in the background check system, and a clerk basically did not follow up and get his check completed in time, and so you only have to wait 3 days. Those 3 days passed, and he went and got his firearm. So the family members wanted to see that done. It was not done. Some have pushed for a hate crimes bill in South Carolina. We're one of the few that still does not have one. That has not been done. So I think they're frustrated that you're not seeing those kind of policy changes either.
Jennifer Barry Hawes is the author of Grace Will Lead Us Home. It's a book about what happened 4 years ago next Monday at the AME Zion, the AME Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. The national story focused on forgiveness. We spent a lot of time in the aftermath of that shooting talking to people about this, including Malcolm Graham, former North Carolina State Senator and a Charlottean who lost his sister. And he told us at the time, and I'm not sure his opinion has changed on this, that he was not willing to forgive the shooter for his sister's death. And there were others, and some members of the same family found themselves on opposite sides with regard to forgiveness. What has that done to those families and or to the church community at large?
Well, to the point of the Grahams, I spoke with Malcolm's brother Melvin, who does live here in town, just the other day, and Melvin was telling me that his family really didn't intend to forgive Dylan Roof. That was a step that they just weren't taking. Now, doesn't mean that down the road they won't. Of course not. But here in Charleston, it did create divisions because there were, even within families, very different opinions. Sharon Risher, who's a Charlotte resident, she did not want to hear her sister talk about forgiveness at the bond hearing. She wanted to, before considering forgiveness, which she knew was something the Bible requires, but she wanted to know what happened. She wanted to come to grips with what happened. She wanted to have time to digest it and deal with her anger and in a meaningful way come to forgiveness, which she did. But it wasn't something that she was going to stand up the following day and say. Other people obviously like her sister. Her sister, Nadine Collier, was the first person to use the word forgive in the bond hearing. Felt that was very important, felt it was important in keeping the peace here, felt it was important in speaking in Christian terms about not only forgiveness, but grace and mercy and those sorts of ideas. So it did create splits, in, as I said, even within families.
It would seem to be a very difficult thing for anybody to do, to forgive an act of of violence like that, that ends in such terrible loss. But for those who did forgive, if you've had an opportunity to speak to them, did it bring them closure? What did it do for them, this act of forgiveness?
Well, I spoke just the other day to Felicia Sanders, who's one of the survivors of the shooting, and she did speak about forgiveness at the bond hearing. She spoke about grace and basically imparting the idea that Rube should repent so that his soul can be saved. And Felicia said that she felt forgiveness was important because for her, it allowed her to keep her sanity and to not be consumed with malice and anger and the things that would do Dylan Roof no harm, but would only harm herself. And, she is a Christian. She believes that God calls you to forgive, and part of her salvation is wrapped in that. And she isn't going to put that at risk for Dylan Roof or anyone else. And so that's her point and the point of others, is that that forgiveness is so that they can maintain their own sanity and not let hate corrode their souls.
You've mentioned that the legislature in South Carolina did not enact any legislation to extend the waiting period for background checks as a result of this. They did not do that. South Carolina remains one of, I think, four states in the nation without a hate crime statute, something I'm sure some of the survivors would like to have seen enacted. How do you explain this lack of action in the face of what happened, in the face of this white-hot national spotlight that was shown on South Carolina in the aftermath of that incident? Is this racially motivated, or does it come from a different place?
Well, as far as gun reforms go, that comes from a political position. Obviously, South Carolina is a strongly Republican state, very pro-Second Amendment, and there's a lot of concern about stepping on gun rights. So that's really more of a political decision. But I think as far as the hate crimes bill and some other issues is that, the farther we get out, the easier it is to forget. And it's easier for people to move on who aren't directly affected. And part of what I wanted to get across with this book was the idea that their lives, they don't get to just go on in their regular life the way we do, that they're still living this every day. And so that while we can move on and maybe get around to this bill or maybe get around to that bill, that they don't have that luxury. That was really the main point I wanted to get across.
That book is called Grace Will Lead Us Home. It's by our guest today, Jennifer Barry Hawes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Charleston Post and Courier, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Jennifer Barry Hawes, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's a religion reporter for the Charleston Post and Courier, and her book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, is the story where all the loose ends of what coverage has brought us in terms of what happened on June 17th, 2015, at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. All these loose ends are tied together in this book, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. The disappointment experienced by some of the survivors does not stop with what the state did not do or the legislature did not do or what did or did not come from this unity march on the Arthur Ravenel Bridge in Charleston. It extends to Mother Emanuel, the church itself, to the because the church lost its pastor in that massacre. It has since experienced numerous turnovers in leadership, and questions arose about how the church handled millions of dollars in donations that flowed in following the massacre. Most of us don't know anything about that. Why the controversy?
The controversy erupted because initially the church, A, was not very transparent about the donations, and then B, never had an independent audit of all of its finances afterward. They had an audit of one fund, which they said they put the donations into, but obviously if you don't put money into that fund, it's not going to show up in an audit of that fund. So they wanted to have an independent audit of the entire church. They were suspicious of what happened to the money, and they also were very disappointed in how the church distributed it, because the church kept more than half of the money for itself and then gave slightly less than half for the nine families to share. So they felt that was unfair, and that if people were sending donations, they intended them to go to the people who were most closely affected by the
shooting. Who made those decisions, and are they still with the church today?
So the interim pastor at the time, he is now the presiding elder, and was at the time the presiding elder of the district, and he's still in place. The church has a different pastor, but he is still there. The larger district that spans the state of South Carolina has a new bishop as well.
Has the Charleston Post and Courier or any other reporting mechanism uncovered any wrongdoing in terms of how these funds were handled? Were they, in fact, mishandled? Was this just misguided thought? What conclusions have been reached?
Yeah, nobody knows because those finances haven't been released, and
even not?
Members of the church, because the church is not obligated to.
Okay, and not even to their own congregation?
Well, that's a source of question. Some congregants of that interim pastor, he had been at a church in Columbia right before this, and some congregants there, in fact, sued the church trying to get their finances because they had some of the same kinds of questions. At Emmanuel, one of the victims' husbands sued Emmanuel, but only got as far as the audit of that one fund I mentioned before he dropped his lawsuit. And as his lawyer told me, I don't want to be the one to cost Emmanuel the Nobel Peace Prize. And so there was a lot of that sentiment of people wanted to challenge the church, but on the other hand, recognized that or they wanted to challenge the church's leaders, but they also did not want to cause more pain for the members. So there was a real tug and pull with that.
So we have this tragedy. We have the loss of senior leadership at the church because of the tragedy. We have the turnover of senior leadership. We have this friction about what happened to the money that came into the church to help the victims. And we have these splits in families with regard to whether they should forgive or should not forgive. What has that done to Mother Emmanuel Church and the people who go there?
Well, it left it in tremendous turmoil. And, you know, you can only imagine what it's like to have your church be a crime scene and then be dealing with all of this. And so the average member of the church, for a long time, I would hear, you know, we don't have space to cry. We don't have the space to heal. They had all of these visitors come through with good intentions, you know, wanting to show remorse and sorrow and camaraderie and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, it was overwhelming. As you mentioned, they had the interim pastor I spoke about earlier. Then they got a permanent pastor, and then she was moved, and they got another pastor, and he's still there now, so that there's been continuity in the senior leadership, at least. But it's been very, very difficult for the members there, no doubt about it.
And the reason this money came in from individual donors from around the country and perhaps around the world was to help the victims' families. Was that the intent of those donations?
Well, that's a big question. Of course, the church, when they kept the majority of the money, said that no, since people sent it to the church, they intended it for the church. But the families argued no, they sent it there because they didn't know where else to send it. Because they didn't know where the individual families lived,
right,
or even sometimes who their family members were. So also they began to get mail from some of the mail that had been sent to the church, they began to then receive from the church. And some of the envelopes would be open, and some people had envelopes that had the word empty written on it. I mean, things that really raised their suspicions. So, you know, maybe nothing unseemly was done, but the reason that it lingers is that they just don't know for sure.
Yeah. And the money, the church kept half the money for itself, but they also gave money to the families of those who lost, had loved ones who lost their lives in that massacre. But then you write about Felicia Sanders, and you've spoken of her earlier today. She, her granddaughter was at the church that night, and she laid on top of her granddaughter to protect her from the shooter. And the granddaughter was traumatized, and so was she. But they didn't get any additional money to help them through their trauma. Both of them, I think, suffer from PTSD. Is that right?
Right. So the church distributed the money so that every family of a victim got the same amount. And then the survivor, Polly Shepherd, who did not lose a loved one in the shooting, but obviously was greatly traumatized. Felicia, who was herself a survivor, and her granddaughter, who was also a survivor, did not receive any additional money. And that was a source of great hurt, and is still to this day for Felicia, because that granddaughter, if her argument is, if people sent money, who of all of the people affected by this would people more want to help than the little 11-year-old girl in the room who saw this all and saw her uncle and her aunt killed and dealt with all this trauma. Who else did they intend to benefit? And now this child will need therapy perhaps for the rest of her life.
Wow.
And so Felicia has been deeply hurt by the fact that the church did not give any of the money specifically to her granddaughter. Also, just simply, she felt, didn't reach out to her at all, that the leadership didn't anyway. Not to say that about the average member, but she felt the leadership basically ignored them.
The shooter had a warped sense of history and of black-white relations, which he gleaned, we are told, from right-wing or alt-right websites, and which he put on display through his own writings on various social media posts. You also point out that the nation, and certainly Charleston, has a curious relationship with the reality of racism. You've already pointed out the fact that tourists come to Charleston because they are attracted by this romantic antebellum illusion that Charleston represents, and that people have weddings at these plantations, which were essentially slave camps. And people look at the gentility of the Old South, which was a complete myth if you were on the other side of the slavery coin. But tourism is a major economic engine for Charleston. So can Charleston ever come to terms with this reality without killing its own economic engine?
I just don't see why they don't go hand in hand. Why is only one side of the history a draw? I find the history of slavery in the South to be one that's extremely interesting and untold. I'm shocked the more that I learn how much I never learned before, how much I just didn't know. And I've lived in Charleston for 20 years. So I think that with the International African American Museum that's being built here and some other endeavors, that we could start to see a more balanced telling of that history. And I don't see why that's not of even greater interest to people. So this idea that, white history has to be told and yet black history is somehow not a draw. I just don't understand that. I think that's a warped telling of it, that both are interesting and they should be told, that the historical context should be accurate and told one alongside the other.
Yeah, you compare these plantations because of their participation in slavery in the antebellum South. As you compare them to Nazi death camps, and we would never think to have a party or a celebration or a wedding at a Nazi death camp, but we do it at plantations. Did this incident open Charleston's eyes in any way to the oddness of that or anything else about its racial background?
I think it cracked it open. I don't think it's fully open, but I think it cracked it open. For instance, the city of Charleston passed an apology on behalf of the city for the institution of slavery. And that was a step. That vote was still narrow, but it was a step. And you hear people like our mayor, John Tecklenburg. I heard him speak at an event recently talking about the workhouse, which is a place where slave owners would send enslaved people to be whipped and otherwise tortured for misbehaving or whatnot. And a lot of people in Charleston don't even know about the workhouse. It was a place of just unimaginable cruelty. And there was Mayor Tecklenburg at an event speaking about it. And so we have greater awareness, I think, but we still have a long way to go.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I don't want to spend much time talking about the perpetrator of this incident because he doesn't deserve the press. But he harbored terribly warped racist views. He's yet to express any remorse. He's constantly stated when he's asked why he did it, he says, "I had to do it." And as you wrote this book and did your research, did Dylann Roof turn out to be an anomaly or merely a visible pimple on this wide-reaching undercurrent of racism?
Right. I think that that's a good way to put it. I think he's more a pimple on it. There's this whole subtext of white supremacist views that lingers and is being fed and grows in these websites that he himself fed off of. Mm-hmm. And those have not gone away. Those still enjoy their membership. And I think that we really need to address those issues. We've seen Other hate-filled white supremacists go into other houses of worship. You know, think about Tree of Life last fall in Pittsburgh.
Right.
Very similar. We've had in many other ones. So we've not addressed the problem, and it's he's just one example.
In the New York Times review of your book, they say you are able to depict, quote, the difficulties faced by Ruth's family without compelling us to feel for them what we feel for the victims and their relatives. What difficulties has his family experienced?
Well, I wish I could tell you more. Honestly, I wish they would share that experience more publicly. But, you know, his mother, for instance, at the trial, the very first day she was there, she essentially sort of passed out in what seemed kind of like a panic attack-ish type episode and then never returned.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only imagine the upheaval that it leaves his family, who played no role in this, to deal with. And I appreciate that reviewer's sentiment because I think it's important to remember them, but I think it's not over the families that he wounded.
You also make an interesting observation. I only have a couple of seconds left about the state of race relations in the shadow of these shootings. You say that white people would say that race relations have improved since the Mother Emanuel massacre, but you say many black people would say the opposite. What do the two sides see?
I think that white residents see their own efforts to reach out, for instance, to the Unity Walk is a good example, and they feel good about that. They want to feel like they're doing something, and in some ways have. But for black residents, it's for many of the reasons we've talked about, they still feel the history is not honest. They still see enormous racial disparities that many white legislators don't seem to care a whole lot about. They're still living with all of those things. And so that sort of superficial nod of unity is not enough in their minds. And so there's a great divide there.
Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Heart-Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness is the name of Jennifer Barry Hawes' book. Thank you for joining us this hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. It was great talking with you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.